As I mentioned before, I was involved in a co-housing group that just moved in June of this year. There are 28 families living in Trillium Hollow is the name of the place, and they ended up choosing to build a sort of a, it looks like an apartment complex, and this is an unusual choice for a co-housing group to make. So there are 28 homes there, ranging from studios to four bedrooms, also ranging from about 600 square feet to about 1600 square feet. And it was a five-year process for them to go through and build co-housing. But I became interested in co-housing when I really felt the isolation that this, our current culture brings about. I lived in downtown Portland and didn't know my neighbors or the neighbors I did know, didn't really want to know me. It was that kind of urban isolation that I think is pretty common. So I was sitting down at breakfast with a couple of friends a few years ago, and we were having one of those really great heavy breakfast meals, and we're talking forever and ever, and we were kind of commiserating about the isolation we felt. My friend Tariko mentioned that she had made a friendly overture towards her new next-door neighbor, and the neighbor was actually quite rude in response to that friendly overture. So we thought, you know, it would be really cool if we could be neighbors, and if we could know our neighbors and have that kind of interconnection. And it was one of those conversations that kind of grew between the four of us that were at that table. Well, a few months later, the Oregonian, which is the Portland area newspaper, published this article that I have here, titled Co-Housing, Building Community from the Inside Out. And it was about Trillium Hollow, the group that just ended up moving in this past June, and about their co-housing development and where they were in the process. And the four of us all thought, this is very cool. This is exactly what our conversation was about. And we later found out that it's very common for people to think about co-housing before they ever find the word or find out that it's being done. So we all got involved. One of the four of us, Tom, was real skeptical at first. He thought, goodness, I don't know that I want to know people this well or have people know me this well. He was very used to living in almost a gated community when he grew up. Tom, though, ended up getting over that quite quickly. He was one of the major members of the what we called the Geek Committee. Taking care of the computers, things like that. And he was also our minute writer, and he did that with a very creative flair. So that was fun. So the people at Trillium started out with the idea, just as the four of us had over a breakfast table conversation, and then they ran into co-housing through some books that they found in the library, really. But co-housing started in the late 60s in Denmark as a really kind of a grassroots type of thing. A few families decided they were tired of living in isolation, and so they built their homes close together with a common house, a house where they can do common activities. The idea spread, and in 1972 the first co-housing place was built in Denmark, and that is now considered a very common form of housing in Denmark and in some other of those countries over there. There is a word that I'm missing. So in the early 80s, Chuck Durrett and Katie McCannett Kamet, architects out of California, went to Denmark and kind of looked at co-housing and thought, well, this is really a very interesting thing. And they looked at it, as architects do, as a combination of housing and community. And they brought this idea back to the States and kind of worked with the first co-housing people in the States. And in, I think it was 88 or 89, the first co-housing community in the United States was built. It was either N Street or Davis Street. I don't remember which one was the first. And they are still a very thriving co-housing community, about 10 years old now. And they were kind of the model for how to do co-housing in the States.
That was in California?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now at this point there are, I want to say, probably about 40 co-housing groups nationwide that are actually built with people living in them. There are probably about 200 or even more than that in some stage of development. That number is continually growing. This past summer, there were a lot of co-housing groups that actually moved in, and so I'm not sure exactly what the accurate number is. But when Chuck and Katie went to Denmark, they came back with kind of the four major principles of co-housing, and I've added a fifth. And I'll write these down on the board. And they can easily be divided between community and architecture, with the understanding that our architecture reflects community. The first, I'm going to go into these in much more detail later. Participatory process, and I can spell participatory. Complete resident management. And creates room for individuals. And this is the one that I've added, the creating room for the individual. On the architecture side, there's intentional design. Common facilities. Okay, so going back with participatory process, co-housing groups are run by consensus. How many of you are familiar with consensus processes? Dan is especially familiar with it in the Holden community. Consensus is a very powerful way to make decisions because it requires the community consent to a decision being made. And consenting and agreeing, I think, are probably two very different things. In consensus, and by that difference I mean you may consent to having the paint in your house be green, but if you were agreeing, you may really have wanted purple and have pushed for that. But you're okay with the decision being green. And that's a much more community-oriented way of thinking about decisions. It's not what I want, but what I think is good for the community. And the two are definitely intertwined, because if what I want is not congruent with what's good for the community, then I need to go back and look at what I really want. But if my needs aren't being met, that's not good for the community. So there's a real balance that has to be carried there. Consensus-based processes also take a lot of patience. and a lot of perseverance. Because it can take a while to work through the issues that come up around everyone in the room consenting to having a decision made. In the process of building co-housing, you're typically working with a $3 to $4 million project, which has people's pocketbooks tightly held into the pot of trying to make decisions. So it definitely lots of patience and perseverance. But when you get that decision made, you know that the community is behind that. And that's where the power comes in. Typically we don't get people undermining that decision. And it really brings you together as a community. Complete resident management. When co-housing people move into what they've built, they run the place. They don't hire in other people to run the place. And that's in contrast to, say, your typical condominium. In a condominium, you would basically hire out somebody to do your landscaping, somebody to do cleaning of the common buildings. In co-housing, that's done by the people who live there. And the decision-making process is also done by the people who live there. And that's a process of taking ownership of what the community owns and also kind of really digging their fingers into it so that it becomes really a part of the community. I think when you hire somebody in to take care of those things for you, you aren't really connected with the place that you've created. Co-housing also creates room for individuals. And this is something I think is really important to point out. A lot of people, when I talk about co-housing, say, oh, it's just like those communes back in the 60s. And in some ways, maybe there's a little bit of that idealism and things like that that are there. But in co-housing, I think there's a recognition that we do live in an individualistic society. And it's probably a little bit foolish to think that we will suddenly be able to make ourselves different people. I'm not explaining this as well as I could. So in order for co-housing to respect those boundaries that we do have as individuals, co-housing is your own home or your own apartment or your own condominium with a kitchen, with a bathroom, everything that your regular house would have. And that's your private sanctuary, your space to be in. And that's a piece that a lot of people don't get when they first hear about co-housing. And the process of building co-housing, you really do get connected not only with the community, but with the place that you're going to be creating for yourself. Also, by creating room for the individual, co-housing people try to recognize that individuals bring different gifts to the community. At Trillium, we had one person who was marvelously gifted at digging ditches. And digging ditches may sound easy, but we learned it is not. There's a process of keeping the ditch level, and we did this for our plumbing system. And figuring out the most efficient way for that ditch to run. And we were very fortunate in having somebody who was very gifted in doing that. So we certainly took advantage of what he was willing to give. We also had another person who was very good at writing, and he was our minute taker that I mentioned earlier. Our minutes for our business meetings would typically have a section at the top that listed all the actions and resolutions for the meeting. And then from there, it was Tom's take on the minutes, on the meeting of that night. And one time that took the form of a five-act Shakespeare Shakespearean sort of play. It was very humorous. And there's talk of reconvening that meeting to do the play. Intentional design. Co-housing is designed for interaction with each other. Your typical housing development is designed for isolation. And let me show you how this usually looks. In your typical housing development, let's say this is your plot of land. And let's say there's a creek on your property like that. What the developer is going to do, the most efficient way for a developer to deal with this plot of land.
How many acres?
Let's say it's four acres. Five acres, yeah. Most efficient way to deal with it is to, say, put a road down the middle and divide it up like that. You could probably even fit more in there. So that you would have a house in each of these little squares. And it does not create a whole lot of room for interaction. If you were really determined, and people are quite often, you could create interaction there, but it's not designed for that. It was certainly not the original intent. Given the same plot of land, a co-housing community would take it, say, here's your creek there, and in fact, this looks a lot like Julian's plot of land. The houses would be clustered. They might even be a little bit smaller than usual. And they would be clustered around a common area. It usually consists of a common house. Common houses tend to be between 4,000 and 6,000 square feet and include a dining hall for common meals 3 to 4 times a week.
Is it all single story?
It depends. It's different from community to community. Trillium used a house that was already on the property for their common house. I think we were the only ones to do that. The activity centers of these houses, basically that's architecture talk for the kitchens, are faced towards pedestrian pathways. Faced towards pedestrian pathways so that when you're walking down the pathway, people can see you. And that provides safety and it provides an opportunity for community to happen. I was up at Trillium on the 4th of July, just going around to say hello to a couple of people. And as I walked down the pathway, I ran into so many people I knew who were just in their kitchens, and they opened the door and said, oh, come in and have a cup of coffee, and these kinds of things. I also ran into a guy that same night who was trying to make some cookies. And he started making the cookies, and he realized, I have no vanilla. This is a problem. So we went to the next door neighbor and got some vanilla, and that took about half an hour because they got into a really good conversation. So we went back to his kitchen and he started mixing up again and realized, I have no sugar. So he said, well, I can't really go back to that person that I just talked to, so I'll go over to these people. And that took him an hour. And then I ran into him as I was walking around, like I mentioned earlier, and we went down and watched the kids doing some fireworks down in the common area. And he never did get back to his cookies that night. So that's the kind of interaction that we're trying for when we design co-housing. Another thing that they do is they try to put the cars away from the community. This is a piece that for practical reasons a lot of communities have trouble with. Because if you have a family with younger children or older people where mobility isn't quite as easy, it is a problem to have your parking that far away. A lot of communities are choosing to have their parking underneath the buildings. That's what Trillium did, and a couple other places have done too. And that seems to work pretty well. But some of the communities, to solve this problem of getting from your car to your house, are putting their parking around the outside edges. And that doesn't seem to be a perfect solution, but it's better than having the first thing you see in somebody's house be a garage. We call those homes with snouts, those ones that are designed with the garage right in front. And then the fifth element is the common facilities, which I talked about in the common house. Typically, a common house will have, like I mentioned, a dining hall, a children's play area, an entertainment room. Invariably somebody decides, we need a room with a big screen TV and a VCR and a video collection. And that usually happens. Usually there's a library, craft rooms. We were also fortunate in having a huge garage on the property that was turned into a shop, so that people who were willing to have their woodworking materials in the community shop did that. And so, place for people to learn and to not have to purchase those huge pieces of equipment. Also, people choose to have things like hot tubs and that kind of stuff. So, any questions on this piece of it here? My next section is going to be on how it actually gets built.
Well, are you going to talk about the balance between the participatory and the space you have as an individual?
Oh, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
One of the underlying principles which creates a balance between the participatory process and creating room for individuals is that one, you don't make any unnecessary rules, and rules tend to be a way for us to avoid talking to each other. It also, and then the second thing is that very little is required, or there are you have the expectation that you will try to help build the community.
Uh-huh.
And what form that takes will be very different from person to person.
Okay.
And usually there are expectations like you'll work in a work party once a month for 4 hours, that you'll try to make a meal once a month. But that's about it, along with your dues for the homeowners association.
So it's not a regular meals like two times a week or something, or what do different people get together, or does the mm-hmm. whole community need to get together, mm-hmm. or what to happen?
Well, there's two ways that happens. One, there's usually a community meeting at least once a month. During the development cycle, so building the place, it's usually once a week. And then there are also evening meal about 3 or 4 times a week. And somebody will volunteer, usually in groups of 2 or 3. They'll volunteer to make a meal for the community. And usually that's on a rotating monthly basis.
Hmm.
And you're not required to go to that meal. And people find that they get feedback on how good their cooking is by how many people attend. There's one group in the Seattle area who's kind of known for its gourmet cooks. And that's the place to go if you want a good meal. And every night that a meal is cooked, the place is packed. There are some people who are known for not being quite so good cooks, and the attendance is low. But that's how community works. That's how we give feedback to each other.
I had a question then. Sometimes you're saying you use existing buildings, and then other times you start from scratch.
Yeah, and I'll get to that in a minute. So we talk about how the place actually gets built.
Well, you know, I've read about Cain and Abel, and I think the problem still exists.
Yeah, there is definitely, you definitely have to be willing to live in community with each other, which can sometimes takes the form of caring for your brother or sister.
Do these places have means of asking the people to leave who will get too obnoxious?
Well, there are the equal housing opportunity laws certainly apply to co-housing, and that requires that we cannot discriminate against people who want to live in co-housing.
In other words, if a full-fledged criminal comes in there, why is it perfectly welcome?
Well, there's a difference between perfectly welcome and allowed to live there. There's a process, usually, there's a process in all co-housing communities of what we call clarification. Other groups call it different things. But basically, we operate under the assumption that co-housing is a self-selecting process. You go to a few meetings and figure out, is this something that worked for me? And then you go to the clarification committee, and it's a process of clarifying what the community expects and hopes for, and clarifying what the individual expects and hopes for, and hoping to come to terms, to come to common ground on those things. And that usually happens. We did have an occasion where, at Trillium, where there was someone who was a convicted criminal who really wanted to become part of the community. And for various reasons, people decided that that was not an okay thing. He was actually a convicted pedophile, and with children in the community, we felt that that was not a good idea. The process that we took with that is we let him know that he was legally allowed to live there, but that we felt that that was not safe for him or for the community, and he eventually decided that that was not where he needed to be.
I wonder if he had decided to live there.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say, you said, you know, all the people invested money in this place.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides to live there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's three families with children that are just anxious about this now.
Yeah.
So, they have invested a large piece of money,
mm-hmm.
and they want to get out or mm-hmm. something because they're anxious about the pedophile. And yet he's legally allowed in there and come in there. Now, what authority, you know, you have no authority as a community, say,
well, you do have legal recourse, as you would in any neighborhood.
Yeah.
And It depends on your state, particular state's laws, and I'm not real familiar with the laws regarding that. I do know that there have not been any co-housing groups who've run into this problem.
Okay.
So the self-selecting process has proven itself so far to be very good.
Mm-hmm.
There is also, I think we come into, as any community, and especially as any Christian community, not saying that co-housing is necessarily Christian, but it's got a lot of, I think there are a lot of parallels. I think we have a responsibility to act in a Christian-like manner and make our needs and wants known and confront this person on that sort of level. And also to be willing to make room for people to change.
Do people, you know, how long is the, you know, do the people live there? For a long time, or do they change every so often? Or what is the general sense of living there?
It varies quite a bit with people's kind of natural tendencies in life.
Who buys your piece when you decide to leave?
There are typically waiting lists.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Not waiting lists in the terms of a hierarchical thing, but in terms of this is a mailing list of people to mail out to if your home does go for sale. There are a lot of people who, once they see co-housing, think, wow, this is a really cool place to be.
And you sell it on your own?
Mm-hmm.
Not through the community?
No, but the community does have first right of refusal. Actually, the legal structure of a co-housing place is typically a condominium association with a few minor changes, and those changes are around actually removing clauses from the condominium documents, standard condominium documents. One of the things that we removed was a clause stating that thou shalt not shake your rugs out your window. We decided that that was probably an unnecessary rule. I do have the condominium documents and bylaws with me here, if that's interesting to you.
You know, I want to make one comment on this undesirable person, because I had some rental places, and there was a guy in that situation. And what happened was the other people sort of made it so uncomfortable, I mean, by almost Amish shunning or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they did anything outward, but it's just that they really didn't want it.
Yeah.
And he moved. Which is good for everybody.
Yeah, I think that there are times when that needs to happen. It's always a hard thing to deal with, and it's hard to know exactly how best to behave in those situations. It's one of those things that we're constantly learning about. Well, I want to move on to the process of building. That's something that's fascinating to me. Here I am.
Topic of what?
Building co-housing. How we get from the idea to actually building and moving in. So we start with the ideas. And then we go to an establishment of covenant. Purchasing land. Going through the design process. Building it. And then moving in. There's also a whole lot of phases that happen after moving, kind of a period of adolescence in co-housing, and then maturing and becoming a mature community. But that's I haven't gone through that piece yet.
So I won't pretend that I know what I'm talking about too much on that one. Ideas. First people get together, kind of like that breakfast that I talked about, where people come together with a lot of ideas and sort of a burning desire to do this. And there's usually a couple of people who are called burning souls, the people who have an amazing amount of energy to put behind this whole process. These are also pretty idealistic people, people who can see a dream and are willing to take it to reality.
Sometimes they turn into big con artists, you know.
Yes, but in the process of the types of people who are really interested in co-housing kind of change over time, and I'll try to narrate that piece too. So you get these people drinking a lot of coffee and eating a lot of breakfast. Then at some point, they decide that this is something that we're going to do. And they establish a covenant with each other. And I have a couple, actually, I think I only have one. I have the covenant that Cascadia Commons, another co-housing group in Portland, put together. And there's also, Janet Grant has put the covenant of a Leavenworth co-housing group on the west wall of the dining hall. And I think it's actually a better covenant than this one. But it basically provides the ground rules for how the community is going to act with each other. And it also says, this is something we're going to do, and this is something that we're going to take the next step on. Usually at this time, financially, people will start paying membership dues. And those dues are intended to cover the cost of, say, printing up marketing materials. Usually they're pretty small at this point, like $5 a month. They also decide the legal structure that they're going to go with in building. And there are two models of the legal and development structure. There's developer-driven, and there is not developer-driven, which is lovingly called the brutal method. When you use, when you don't use a developer, you have to come up with the money to purchase the land, to pay the designers, to get a construction loan, and pay all the administrative costs, and then you pay all that back with your mortgage. When you have a developer, you only have to pay the developer a small amount of money up front, and then that developer purchases the land, pays for all of this, and then you pay that developer back with your mortgage. It's a much simpler, much easier way to do it. When you're doing it via the brutal method, though, which does have some appeal in that you have a lot more control over what you end up with. It also tends to be more expensive, though. And I can talk on and on about that piece, but we do need to move on. Also at this point, legally, some kind of company is developed. We created an LLC, a limited liability corporation, that allowed us to take membership dues. It also allowed us to go with the next step of purchasing land. The reason why we chose an LLC is because it fits really well with the consensus-based process.
You're now talking about the ability to take off the interest on the house for income tax purposes, is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that.
Well, I don't either, but that's supposed to be what we can do at our house.
Ah, Well, the way the Trillium was developed is that there were 12 families that were in a position to be able to mortgage their homes because they owned them free and clear. And they actually invested the money to buy the land. And then they were the original members of the LLC. And that helped get to the point of design. At that point, new members were asked to put down 10% of their expected home price that would then be counted towards their mortgage. That would be their down payment on their mortgage at the end. Okay, so moving on. Co-housing, in my mind, becomes real when you purchase your land. That is the hardest part for a co-housing group to do. Once they get there, it's all downhill from there. The ball is kind of rolling. There are a lot of groups that die before they get to the purchasing land part. And that happens for a lot of reasons. It's hard to come to consensus about what kind of land you're going to purchase. It's hard to find land. There are some co-housing groups that choose not to buy a new piece of land, but will renovate an existing neighborhood. There are lots of ways that that's done. So, from the land, at this point, when land is purchased, there's kind of an influx of people who are a little bit more reality-based than the idealists who started out this thing. This is the phase where I came into Trillium Hollow and those three other friends of mine. It's a time when a lot of professionals, people who have money but don't have children, and are people who are willing to take a fairly large risk, because the level of risk is still pretty high at this point. Then you get into designing, working with the architects, or if you have a developer, working with the developer who's working with the architect. The actual building. The building part is fun, but it's not, usually it's contracted out, and so it's not a part that the community's terribly involved in, except for making decisions about where the boiler's going to be placed, and if it should be under somebody's bedroom or over somewhere else. It's amazing what people can get stuck on. And then the process of moving in. Moving from going from a community that meets once a week for business meetings to a community that lives together in close proximity with each other is a huge step to take. There are lots of kind of gatherings that take place around the process of moving in, around preparing for that big step, deciding where the library is going to be, deciding how they're going to do common meals, restructuring committees, that kind of thing. And then after move-in happens, people settle in and they decide, my goodness, the library doesn't work there. And there's kind of a shuffling around and people, you know how when you move into your house, you decide over here and then 2 weeks later you decide, nope, they need to be over here. Imagine 28 families doing the same thing. It's quite a process, and it takes a lot of perseverance. Are there any questions about the process?
Well, it makes a lot of sense because there are many things you share, or you need a ladder once every 3 months or something. And mm-hmm. So just economically, makes a lot of sense.
A lot of sense. Ladders and woodworking equipment and lawnmowers.
Julie, you said you came in when the land was being purchased.
Mm-hmm.
And, the dreamers were in the idea stage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're forming a consensus and knowing one another and so on, and then all of a sudden you can be with the three other people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does the process work? For you as a new person, the dreamers have a lot of investment and a lot of ideas, and you are new and you come in with new ideas.
Yeah.
And how does that, you know, tell your story? How did it work for you?
Well, the three of us came in at a time when the community was pretty tired. They'd been working for the last 3 years to buy land. And
3 years.
It took them 3 years to buy land and then 2 years to get to the move-in stage.
Wow.
And that's actually pretty good.
It's a long time.
Yeah, it is a long time. So there was a combination of people being so glad that there were new people with fresh energy and fresh blood mm-hmm. to come in and help with that. Mm-hmm. There were definitely people who had a lot of investment in how things went. And I think that's one of the beauties of a consensus-based process is that on both sides of that, we were required to listen to each other. And there were lots of conversations, just basically sat down and made our needs known. There were people who were leading committees who didn't want to lead committees. So there was an excellent time for that kind of interchange to happen. And then when the building's actually built there, that's when the young families with kids come in, because when you actually see a structure there, it's really easy to invest yourself into it. Before that point, you really are taking a big risk, financially and emotionally. And so that's another time when you get some fresh blood in. And I know at that point I really needed that too.
Talked about the risk financially. What is the risk that you talked about?
Well, when you're using a developer, your risk is actually pretty low.
Mm.
When you're not using a developer, brutal method, and it earns that name. What I did at the purchase of the land, I put $12,000 down on the place that I was going to buy. And that I risked losing that money. If the project somehow went over budget, if we ran into something that meant the project couldn't be built at all, I'm out $12,000. And there were people who were invested a lot more deeply than that. So financially, when the building's actually in the process of being constructed, you have a really good idea exactly how much it's going to cost you. And so you aren't taking that kind of financial risk.
What about leaving the co-housing situation? I mean, you did that.
Yes, I did.
So how does that happen? How does that work?
The way we did it is that, the way I did it is that I let my ex-husband buy the unit. But that's another story. The way most people do it is you sign an agreement that if you choose to drop out of the process before move-in, your money, your 10% down, stays in the pot until all units have been sold. So until this move-in process is complete. It didn't always work that way. There were a couple of people who wrote to us, since it's a consensus-based process, and since all of the rules were mostly guidelines, we had a couple of people who dropped out and said, if you can find a way to give us some money, that would be great. If you can't, we understand, we signed this agreement. And earlier in the process, it's easier to pay those people back than later in the process when the money is tied up in the construction loan. Mm-hmm.
So what about leaving it after everyone has moved in, and what were the agreements around that?
Well, leaving it after everyone's moved in, you're basically selling your home.
You're just, okay.
Just like you normally would.
And does that mean finding someone else who's willing to live in the co-housing situation?
Yeah, it does. But you typically have a waiting list to draw upon.
Oh, really?
And you have a first right of refusal, so maybe someone, friend of one of those people, has someone who wants to live.
Mm-hmm. There are... there are definitely people who decide, I've got this three-bedroom home and I'd rather have a two-bedroom or the other way around, and so a lot of switching happens. Kind of like housing at Holden.
Mm-hmm. Can you keep it rented?
Yes, definitely.
You can.
Oh yeah. And there are co-housing groups who make homes that are specifically for renting, because One of the downsides of co-housing is that you typically are attracting white middle-class people who are able to buy their own homes, typically. And it's usually white because, one, that reflects our economic situation, and two, there are a lot of ethnic communities who have community figured out, and there isn't as much of a draw. There's a whole big issue around that too.